Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Toby Dogweiler, who's a department chair in Geography, Geology, and Planning here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Toby.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Toby, you and I have talked about climate change before, and it's been on my mind a lot lately with various kinds of things that I've read on my news sources that I look at, and perhaps some sensationalism and other kinds of things. But what I've been thinking a lot about is this whole long-term versus short-term. I myself have gotten the tendency to think, well, my great-grandchildren are going to really have to worry about whether they can live on the coastline, and it has become rather easy for me to not worry about short-term implications of this. Tell me how I'm perhaps incorrect on the way it's sort of been resonating with me.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize and the press doesn't cover as well as they probably could is we're experiencing climate change today. Our coldest years right now over the last few decades are warmer than our warmest years prior to that. We've got sea level change that's causing flooding on a regular basis in Miami during high tides. We've got agricultural impacts that are profound in the Midwest. This year is a great example with all the flooding that's occurred, but year in and year out, just in the average year now, it's wetter in the spring when farmers are trying to get their field work done. It makes it harder to get a crop in. And once they get it in, summers are drier. There's less, fewer rainstorms, but when it does rain, it rains harder. So more droughty conditions with these large magnitude storms. And then in the fall, if they've got something to harvest, it tends to be wetter than average, and it makes the field work harder. I think in the Midwest, that's one of our biggest effects. It's not the temperature that I'm worried about here where we live. It's the changes in the rainfall pattern and precipitation that are really going to affect us in this region.
Well, you know, one thing about it is with the models, of course, most average people are going to feel, when I say average, I mean people that are not trained in the use of these models, myself included, are going to feel in over their heads because it seems so subtle. So lead us through a little bit, because you and I have talked at length about this together, lead us through a little bit about the modeling procedure, because people worry about this. They say to themselves, well, how can anybody know any of this stuff? So briefly, just sort of talk about what people are trying to do when they look at these models.
Well, before I answer that, I'm going to go back and make one more point about the advantage of focusing on the current problems we're having with climate change. And that's not a model-based observation.
Right,
those are
right.
Observable data. It's yes. Wetter in certain times of years. It's drier in other parts of the year. Flooding is occurring in Miami and so forth. Those are all things we're observing now. That's not model data. Now, the model data from even 20 years ago predicted a lot of these things and said that that was what the future was going to look like, and now that those predictions have come true. But if we want to talk a little bit...
When I say about the models, talk about the driving... See, because people mm-hmm. are going to think to themselves, well, nature's nature, and there's nothing we can do about it, so it's wetter now and so forth. And they're going to throw up their hands and say, I'm just going to see what happens. And sometimes I think that's the response. They worry that, yes, they think it is hotter if they got down to it, but they don't know what in the heck they can really do about it. So with the models, I mean, there are really driving forces in these models as to how the feedback begins to cause these kinds of things. Maybe just do 1 minute on that.
Well, I think what the models can help us do is understand if we add a certain amount of carbon to the atmosphere, how much more warming can we expect? How's that going to affect precipitation patterns? How's that going to affect sea level? How's it going to affect all these aspects of the climate? It helps us plan and make predictions about the future. Of course, if you're building infrastructure now, or even if you're just an architect designing a building, you need to be able to have some idea about what it's going to be like in 10 or 20 right. years so that you can design appropriately. The models can help us do that. The models are quite accurate. They're well calibrated, meaning that just to simplify it for a second, somebody doesn't just put a model together and then crank some numbers out and say this is what the future is going to look like. They put actually the one way that a model is calibrated is you go back and maybe put starting conditions for 1950 in, and you model from 1950 to today, and you make sure that the model can forward predict that period where we already know what happened. And if it can take 1950 observations and predict 2018, then you have some confidence when you start it in 2019 and try to predict what's going on in 2060 or 2070 or 2100.
Well, one of the fascinating things for me is that people, when it comes to science, trust scientists, but only to a point. So, for example, if they go to one of these doctors and the doctor is going to shape their cornea, they're perfectly okay with the doctor putting a laser into their eye. Whereas the amount of research that was done was substantial, done by laser scientists who invented the particular kind of laser, whatever kind of laser it might be, to the people who designed the fiber optics so that you could direct it properly and map the cornea and all this. So people are always hanging their own lives on the work of scientists. But yet when it comes to something like this, many times they start to say, well, these scientists don't know what they're talking about. I want to talk about something you mentioned to me where you said that you can see these effects and they're very subtle. You mentioned something about the Clean Air Act. You and I were talking about it. These little subtleties that the average person wouldn't think to take into account. So talk a little bit about this issue, about some temperature anomalies that we're seeing in the mid part of the last century.
Well, okay, this is a really interesting topic, and it's difficult to explain. It's probably going to be even harder on the radio without visual support. But the basic idea is that in the industrialization that happened from World War II through the late 70s or early 80s, we really saw in the long-term temperature trend it kind of flattened out. There wasn't really any warming or cooling, net cooling of the globe during that time. The temperatures, there were warm years, there were cool years. It was sort of what you would expect in a non-changing climate. Prior to that, prior to World War II, temperatures had been steadily rising since the 1850s or 1880s. And since about 1980, they've really taken off and have risen really fast. But that mid-century period was a very flat period of temperature. There wasn't much change. What it turns out to be, in hindsight now, we understand that there was very little clean air regulation from World War II through the early 1970s. So there was a lot of pollutants, including sulfur compounds emitted out of smokestacks. Turns out sulfur compounds are cooling gases. Just like carbon dioxide is a warming gas, sulfur compounds tend to be cooling gases. And so what was happening was we were spewing out all of these sulfur compounds into the atmosphere, and they have a daytime cooling effect. They don't make any difference at night, but they block incoming sun rays. So they depressed the signal of warming during the day. If you look at just nighttime highs from the 1800s through to today, it's a steady increase. If you look at daytime highs, it tailed off, maybe even decreased a little bit during that post-war period through the 70s. Then what happens is the Clean Air Act gets passed in the early 70s. Pretty rapidly, we get those smokestack emissions under control. And as we do that, those sulfur compounds don't last long in the atmosphere. They get rained out pretty quickly, unlike carbon dioxide, which once it's up there stays up for a long time. The sulfur compounds get rained out. And so now that effect is no longer there from about the early 80s, and then the signal returns for the increasing temperatures. Now, I would like to say before anybody out there decides, well, the solution to climate change is we just
start polluting,
that there were all kinds of negative effects,
sure.
You know, sure. Respiratory diseases, all kinds of other diseases. Lots of people were impacted medically and in other ways, and we had a lot of clean water problems from
acid rain. Sure.
So it's not the solution, but it's an interesting it's an interesting example. And the other thing I would say about that period was, for a long time, this was sort of the mystery of climate change, and one of the causes of uncertainty was, why did this happen in the mid-century? Why was the temperature change so flat during that period? Why wasn't the long-term trend carried through there? And it took some study Those questions were asked by scientists. They made the observations of that anomaly during the mid-century, started to investigate it, and were able to elucidate the causes of it, the story that I just told you.
Well, you know, the reason I point this out is because I really feel like a lot of the public think that climate scientists, especially for whatever reason, are just running along doing all kinds of weird stuff and making stuff up. There's subtlety here, would you agree, that scientists spend a great deal of time trying to figure out. They don't just say, well, we'll cover this up with some term. They say, let's try to tease this out. Would you agree that it's subtle, but that scientists have spent a tremendous amount of time trying to understand the subtlety?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think scientists are trained skeptics. When somebody presents new results that buck the trend or the conventional wisdom, there's always a lot of pushback against that. And science is worked out through the repetitive process of replicating data and showing that those new observations pan out in a lot of different scenarios and experiments. So, and scientists can be are typically very much sticklers for detail in the peer review process and the other ways that we validate science and move forward. It's a competitive sport.
Right. And to me, that's very interesting because people would think something like that attached to or associated with something like, let's just real quickly mention something like plate tectonics, which everybody pretty much says, yes, this happens. But that wasn't always true that everybody agreed on that. It was considered quite sort of a strange thing to believe. I feel like people think that there's a cabal going on amongst climate scientists. Disabuse us of that notion that any of these scientists sat around and decided for some inexplicable reason that, the temperature of the Earth increasing will become some sort of a mantra for us.
Well, I think that, first of all, it just comes down to this one simple way is if somebody could come up with data that supported that climate change wasn't occurring and that our current interpretations of all the observations were wrong, I mean, this person would be a household name. They'd probably win a Nobel Prize. This would make their whole career. So there's every motivation in the world to disprove the current understanding. And that's not just in climate science. I mean, if somebody could overturn the theory of relativity, overturn Einstein, they'd literally be the next Einstein, right?
That's absolutely true.
So there's every motivation in the world to be the contrarian and to disprove the current status because the textbooks will be written about you. You know, you will find money, you will find fame.
Right. Whereas this idea of a cabal, people don't know scientists very well, I think, to believe that they would all get together to cook the books, as it were. Would you agree that that's an underestimation of the humanity of scientists?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that, most people who go through the process of earning a PhD, becoming a research scientist, they're doing that for the pursuit of truth. And I know that sounds idealistic and corny, but it really is true. Many of these people could make a lot more money if they had gotten out of school earlier with a master's degree, and just gone into, industry. They're doing it for the love of the science, the pursuit of the truth, the better understanding of the world we live in. It really is a very idealistic profession, and that just doesn't suit itself to, some cabal conspiracy idea.
And also, naturally, scientists, as you already mentioned, are competitive. They want to publish, and they're not going to go along with the crowd. Just go along to get along is not something I would ever ascribe to a scientist.
And I think the other way I'd look at this is there is a lot of debate in the scientific community about climate change. It's not about whether climate change is occurring or not. That's settled science. It's about the details. How fast are we going to get to 2 degrees C above pre-industrial temperature levels globally? What effects are we having on the global oceanic currents like the Gulf Stream with the changes we're seeing in the atmosphere and the ocean? A real set of controversy over the last couple decades has been in hurricane science. You know, how much are hurricanes being affected by the warmer atmosphere, the warmer ocean? Are hurricanes stronger, more intense, more frequent? That's a very although it's more settled than it was 10 years ago, there's still a lot of controversy, and it's very open-ended, and there are scientific research labs out there that, you know, it's like you can eat popcorn while you watch these people argue with one another at a conference because it's such a heated debate. So it's not, you know, a cabal. There's a lot of competition out there to define and refine and improve our understanding of these details. And there are a lot of questions there.
So that segues right into the next thing I'm thinking about, which is this idea of settled science. So I read a lot of a particular news station that shall remain unnamed, and they have a lot of articles that are about all sorts of things. It could be an epidemic of mosquito-borne illness, it could be hurricanes, it could be extra rain, it could be bad crops. And many times they'll throw a tag in at the tail end of their headline that says something about climate change. And I become actually annoyed by this because I feel like they just don't think that people are going to be interested unless it's like, holy crap, we're going to die, climate change. And so do you think that they need to be, or anybody needs to be, spending so much time trying to, let's say, convince the general populace still that this is a problem? Or are we looking at this the wrong way? And should we be focused on something else?
Well, I personally think that we shouldn't focus so much on the quote-unquote controversy of climate change, because public polling supports that both in the U.S. and around the world that most Americans, most global citizens accept that climate change is occurring. They may have questions about how much or what those effects are, but they understand that changes are occurring. And I really think that these very vocal skeptics are a very small minority, even of the general public. So I think that we'd be better served by focusing on what are the solutions and debating those. If we put as much energy into debating the best ways to address climate change, for instance, how do you, maybe if a carbon tax is the best approach, which a lot of economists support, how would you structure that carbon tax? That's an economics question and a policy question, and that deserves a lot of debate. That's not something that's settled. The details of how you do that. So I think that's where our energy would be better served.
Now, you've talked to people about climate change. I know you and I've discussed this, and you've done a lot of sort of public outreach associated with this. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that people either think one of two things. Either there's nothing we can do about it, let's hang on for the ride at some level, and this is going to turn my world upside down to a level that I'm not comfortable with, whether that's direct economic outcomes associated with, let's say, large businesses, or somebody thinking that they aren't going to be able to take their boat to the lake, or whatever it is. So what about inertia? Is it just that there's just too much inertia in policy? And is that because of the general populace, or is it really laid at the feet of politicians?
Oh, I think there's something about the human condition here, and there's actually apparently some research to show this, that we're really bad at thinking about long-term consequences. This is why most people don't save enough for retirement. You know, they're more worried about what's happening today than what might be happening in 20 years, but their financial need today versus their financial need when they're in retirement. And so that affects, but that's also the other advantage then of really refocusing at least part of our climate discussion on that we are experiencing effects today. These aren't just things that are going to happen in 2080 or 2090. These are things that are happening in 2019. And then, you know, the financial consequences. I think when people tell me, well, we can't afford to address climate change, the question that I ask is, okay, but tell me, how much is it going to cost us to do nothing? Because that's not going to be free either. I don't exactly know how much it's going to cost to do nothing, but I know it's going to cost something. And I don't think anybody would debate that in an honest argument.
Right. I agree with that. But of course, then they would say, well, something terrible happened, and then I responded to it. And so people always feel maybe not good about it, but they feel that they have to do something. So when tornadoes come in and tear things up, I've actually seen articles from certain columnists who suggested that there shouldn't be aid given to people who put themselves in harm's way. Of course, that would be nearly everybody in the country. If you build near the banks of the Mississippi, sooner or later, there's going to be trouble. If you build any place in a hurricane region, there's going to be, you know, I mean, we couldn't account for all of that. But people in general, when they see disaster, they say, well, we throw money at the disaster. On the front end, they feel like they're throwing money at nothing. So I would say, and help me out here, but I would say that I haven't seen anything on a policy level generally that has addressed any of this. About 15 years ago, from a particular couple of politicians, there was a lot of talk about cap and trade and so forth. I don't hear much about this at all now. Is anybody really talking about this problem?
I fear not, not really at a policy level, a serious policy level in legislatures or in Congress. And in fact, there's been some very counterproductive things happening. It might even be about a decade ago now. The North Carolina legislature, I think it was North Carolina, it might have been South Carolina, one of them passed a law that requires their state agencies to only consider a linear amount of climate of sea level rise. So, you know, there's
Oh yes, I remember that.
You know, and the data show that the rate of sea level rise has been exponential over the last century and is likely to continue to accelerate over this century. So, you know, legislating that your regulators and the people who are trying to deal with these problems has to. Basically, you're making a law there that says you have to stick your head in the sand and pretend that what's happening isn't happening. That's not a good policy or a place to start making policy from.
That's so interesting to me. It has to be that people think that their ox is going to get gored. The primary players you would think on this are the petroleum industry and people that burn things for a living. What kinds of ways are there around that, do you suppose? I mean, this becomes more policy than anything else. But in a public education sense, how can you get people to decouple their economic wealth or whatever from this problem? Is there a way to do that?
I don't know if there's a way to decouple that, but my response is really, let's just talk about what is your real cost right now as a taxpayer. There's strong evidence that Hurricane Harvey was made maybe up to 40% worse by climate change. And Hurricane Harvey cost billions and tens of billions of dollars that were paid for by the American taxpayer. As an American taxpayer, that was money out of my pocket and out of your pocket and everybody else's. Would we be better off to have policies that reduce that impact and save that money up front? So maybe it costs us some. Maybe we're paying a carbon tax up front, and maybe in the long term, because that carbon tax goes towards disincentivizing the emission of carbons, that causes all these natural disasters to be smaller, which saves us on insurance, it saves us in taxes in a different place. Maybe that's the way we need to think about
this. Well, this ties into something you and I were talking about, long-term small iterative things versus catastrophic things. We were talking about nuclear power and about this idea that the big problem with nuclear power is that when there are problems, the problems usually look pretty doggone horrific and big, but that there are problems associated with almost everything we do. So is it partly, like for example, in energy production, when you burn things, there are negative consequences. It's just that they're not going to be clearly apparent. Are people good at, is it just their risk assessment is so poor that they can't identify these small additive risk?
Well, I think people are pretty smart and could put these pieces together if it were presented in rational, straightforward ways by our media. And as you said, the media tends to hype some of the more sensational aspects of climate change rather than focusing on these more mundane but maybe important aspects of the debate. And I really think that that's true. But on the other hand, I also think that people have lots of other priorities in their life. They're worried about their day-to-day, getting the kids to school, you know, being successful at work, doing whatever they need to do to their house this weekend. There's lots of different things that motivate people, and that's why policy is important. we need to be able to depend on our policymakers to represent us in government and to put in place good policies that make sure that companies and government agencies are working together to solve these problems on our behalf. It doesn't mean that there's no individual responsibility here, but these are big problems. That's why we have a government, to deal with the big problems that we can't deal with just individually.
Right. Well, this speaks to a broader question, which I've thought about a lot, which has been going on, I would say, for a couple of decades, from probably the best time for scientists, which would have been in the aftermath of World War II, where in some cases scientists were viewed as the saviors of mankind at some level, to now where science many times is viewed with skepticism, and rightfully so, since scientists are skeptics, but that people, even after the abundance of data suggests an outcome, still aren't willing to buy in because of some innate almost distrust. Are you getting that feeling? I certainly am getting that feeling that there's less, people feel there's less reason to respect or trust what scientists are telling them.
I'm going to respond to that in two ways. First, I think that that effect is really focused on a couple of issues that are very politically charged, ideologically charged, like climate change, maybe some aspects of stem cell research and some things like that, maybe evolution. And that overall, if we look at the whole body of science, I think most people are very accepting of new information, new results, new understandings as they come out. It's just in these very politically charged sort of aspects that also happen to be very important and get most of the press, right?
Yeah, it's really ironic, though, because if anybody had told you, let's say, 100 years ago, you know what will become really, really politically charged is whether the Earth is just getting warmer at a rate that's going to hurt us. Most people would say, who could find that a politically charged thing? Saying something like Darwin said, you can see because of various kinds of proclivities people have that that's going to resonate in negative ways for many people. Of course, it's been accepted science amongst almost all of biology for many years. But I don't think I could have predicted, even when I was 10 years old, if somebody had asked me, people are going to really get all up in arms about this question. It just doesn't seem like that emotional of a question.
Well, I think that goes back, though, to it's how's that old saying go? It's hard to make somebody believe something that goes against their wallet. And we have some very entrenched, very wealthy special interests out there that have a big interest in not addressing this problem head on. And they've had an outsized influence on this debate.
I would agree with that.
And that's what I think it comes down to, because, like I said, most people otherwise, if you take that political charge out of these issues, you know, all other science people tend to, you know, they don't feel like, I think if you take that political charge out of these debates in other aspects of science, people aren't challenging or denying in the way they are here. And when they do, like with the flat earthers, they're mostly just cast aside as people who are out there on the fringes.
Right. Well, this is a very deep discussion, and unfortunately one that I do not feel like is being held, to be honest, even amongst some of the, let's say, the most notable journalists and politicians, I don't feel like are really addressing this at all. It seems like it's gone way down on the list of things people are thinking about in sort of the context of the times that are going on now. Would you agree with that? I just don't hear much about it anymore, except as a tagline on every single bad thing that happens.
I think in general, I agree we could have better coverage of this. But with that said, there are some journalists out there like Andrew Revkin, Chris Mooney, and some others that are very knowledgeable about this topic and in many ways almost as knowledgeable as the PhD level scientists who they're covering, just because they've done the homework, they've read the work, they've been to the conferences, they've interviewed the scientists, they have a huge handle on the topic and write really good stuff about it. But they do seem to be the exceptions. I think a lot of the other coverage is more superficial.
Well, Toby, we are getting to the point where we probably need to wrap it up. I thank you so much for stopping by today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.